Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation.
The entire cost is approximately $375,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org
or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
And so we have to be honest with the American people. They're tough. They know, as Franklin Roosevelt said, things get worse and worse before they get better and better, but you got to level with the American people, shoot from the shoulder. There's never been a time they've not been able to step up. This president should step down.
Instead of letting Washington change us, and despite all that we've all gone through, we are changing Washington. That's what's been happening. And just in conclusion, and I hate concluding with you because I like you. I like you. I don't know why the hell I like Wisconsin, but for some reason.
That's a Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden, speaking during a CNN town hall, and President Donald Trump speaking at a Wisconsin rally last night. I guess you could say things are heating up. Both candidates are on the trail insofar as they can be, given continuing COVID restrictions. There is a difference of tone in the two campaigns, the president tending to be more upbeat and Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden, well, painting a picture that's a little more gloomy. Welcome back to Issues Etc., coming to you live from the new studios of Lutheran Public Radio in Collinsville, Illinois. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be getting an update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Politics and Molly Hemingway of Fox News. Then we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We've got our four soundbites ready to go. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, or by sending us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet @issuesetc. Or you can wait until we're playing in about a half hour and give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. In the meantime, it's time for an update on the November elections. Joining us to do so, Mark Hemingway. He's a regular guest and senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, welcome back.
Glad to be back.
And Molly Hemingway, Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, and co-author of the book Justice on Trial. Molly, welcome back to you.
It's great to be here with you.
Molly, what are your thoughts on Joe Biden's performance last night at his CNN town hall?
Joe Biden was able to go on a very friendly media outlet and have very friendly questions from the audience, and he did very well, I thought. It was a good example of how Joe Biden does well when he doesn't have conflict or people that he's opposing in questions, and when he has the opportunity to emphasize his campaign message, which is that Donald Trump is evil. And so all of the questions were setups for him to be able to expound on that point. So I think he did fairly well. It was also one of the first times you've seen him around actual people. He hasn't done a lot of campaigning, and he certainly hasn't done any retail-type campaigning. Sometimes he'll get on a plane and go somewhere and meet with four people, and they'll take pictures of that. But this was actual voters, people who are already friendly to him, but it was a big improvement over what he'd been doing in previous weeks.
How did it impress you, Mark?
Well, I mean, I don't know necessarily if it did. I mean, part of the problem here was, you know, as Molly sort of alluded to, was the setup and the format. I mean, according to Politico, this is from Politico's write-up of the event today, if ABC's event with President Donald Trump was an icy grilling, CNN's drive-in conversation with Joe Biden Thursday was more like an affable reunion of old acquaintances. And then they list the top moments from CNN's Kid Gloves town hall with Biden. It seems pretty clear to me that the media are not in any way, shape, or form pretending that they have to treat each other, you know, each candidate equally and ask tough questions equally. So, yeah, Biden didn't do poorly. You know, Molly says, you know, he may have even done well in certain circumstances, although there was one tough question where I think Jim Gary at National Review aptly described it, word salad is a thing. This was word chop salad, where Biden attempted to answer a question about regulations and failed miserably. But these comparative things aren't really telling us anything about
So, Molly, you wrote about a false claim that was repeated by Biden last night. What was it?
Well, it was in the town hall last night. He was asked something about the lives of black people and how tough they are. And he responded in part by making a claim that he got in a huge amount of trouble for claiming back in 1988. And the claim, which is not true, is that he is the first person in his family to have gone to college. Now, the reason why he was saying this back in 1988 is because he was lifting an entire speech from a British labor politician named Neil Kinnock. And this guy had a great line about how he was the first man in 1,000 generations to have gone to college. And Joe Biden just lifted that entire line. And so it wasn't just that he was plagiarizing a speech. He was also just making stuff up that wasn't true. He actually came from a long line of people who had gone to college. And it's just something that he had to apologize for back in 1988. So it was really surprising to see him. It actually forced him out of the race back in 1988, a series of scandals involving plagiarism, rampant dishonesty about his academic record, and then also the plagiarism of speeches. It wasn't just Neil Kinnock. It was a bunch of other people, including various Kennedys and other people. He was just stealing their lines and appropriating them for his own. With the Kinnock stuff in particular, it was bad because he was actually stealing his biography and claiming it as his own when it wasn't true. And he did it again last night. But the media loved it. They thought it was one of the best lines of his speech. And it made me realize they don't even remember what happened in 1988. Maybe they weren't alive or knowledgeable, but they should probably read up on that race and what forced him out.
Mark, Biden has promised to release a list of possible Supreme Court justices. Do you think he will?
Well, I mean, he would have to do it, obviously, very soon. I mean, I don't know. Maybe things have changed with the, Trump appointing two Supreme Court justices and all the furor over Kavanaugh. But I don't see any big indication that the Democratic base is in any way as motivated by judicial nominations the way that the conservative base has been post-Roe. So, releasing a list in many respects would probably, given the nature of the Democratic Party right now, where a tiny minority of very, crazy left-wing activists are very successfully pushing the leaders of the party, farther left than they want to be to appeal to the mass electorate, I don't see any big advantage for him to release a list, because what's going to happen here is that there's going to be a lot of, public complaints about the nominations on the list not being left-wing enough, I imagine, and Biden would have to be engaged in some sort of inter-party sparring in order to alleviate that with, weeks before the election. I just don't see any big advantage for him to do it.
What about you, Molly?
It's a completely opposite situation in the Democratic Party from the Republican Party. So when Donald Trump issued his list, which he has revised over the years, of who he would nominate to the Supreme Court, it has been something that has comforted Republican voters who have felt that Republican candidates going back to Eisenhower, Republican presidents going back to Eisenhower, have completely failed with their nominations to the Supreme Court. Even though they've had all these nominations that they could have really shaped the court in a good way, they have made bad decisions. And so by Trump releasing his list, it was a way to assuage the fears of voters that if they voted for another Republican, that they would do what the predecessors had done. And people continue to demand that Trump be transparent and show he'll choose from this list for the Supreme Court. With Democrats, they want someone far to the left. And if Joe Biden were to, with the Democratic base, if Joe Biden were to admit that publicly, it would be a disaster for him with the general population. And so it's very important for Democrats to hide what their plans are with the Supreme Court, whether that's who they would nominate or what they might do in terms of stacking the court or otherwise. They kind of wink to their base, but they don't want to get too public where they'd be held to account for the radical views of the type of justice that they would like to see on the court. So I would not expect Joe Biden to release a list, even though it would be very nice for voters who are making a decision between the two candidates to have a good idea of their difference.
Molly, earlier this week, both Biden and Democratic vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris used the term Harris-Biden ticket, reversing the traditional order of how the candidates are named, of course. Will the Trump campaign capitalize on these slips? And is Harris the weaker of the two candidates on that ticket?
I think there's no question that Biden squandered an opportunity with his vice presidential nomination. He picked someone in Kamala Harris who's really radical and unappealing to centrist voters. It's unclear if she's like a huge problem, but she definitely wasn't a huge lift. And contrary to what a lot of people think, vice presidential picks actually can be very significant and helpful. They usually don't hurt too much. It's unclear exactly what's going on here, but I don't think Kamala helps. I think the Trump campaign wants to run against Joe Biden as opposed to Kamala Harris, but they're happy to run against both of them because they both present their opportunities for attack. I was surprised not just that Kamala Harris referred to it as her administration. She said it in a Harris administration, but that Biden did the same thing the next day. It made it seem like, are they actually wanting people to think that Harris would be the, would, you know, that if they were elected, that Biden would soon step down and turn the reins over to Kamala Harris? Because it seems that people are far more favorable to him than they are to her.
Mark, what do you make of what could have been either an intentional trial balloon or just, in the case of Joe Biden, a simple slip of the tongue?
Well, I don't know. You know, with Biden, there's, you know, two ways of sort of looking at that. You know, obviously he's either, could just be, you know, simple him being addled, you know, or it could be, you know, that there's something more going on there that even he recognizes, you know, in terms of his relationship with his vice president. I just have a hard time imagining that this isn't a factor in what's going on here. And then under normal circumstances, you know, the media would be openly talking about it, but we're not. And what does that tell us? It tells us, I think, that people don't want to have an honest conversation about the particular dynamic here.
Mark, I'm curious as to your thoughts on why we're hearing Joe Biden. I think I might be wrong, but more often, and maybe for the first time, saying at the end of some of his zingers during his campaign speeches, this president must step down. What is the political calculus there of calling for Donald Trump to leave office?
So I think it's, you know, him trying to appease the left or whatever on some level. And on another level, I think it's simply that there's been this really dangerous thing that's been mainstreamed into the Democratic Party discourse right now. And by Democratic Party discourse, I mean the mainstream media discourse as well. There's a piece in the Washington Post today quoting a variety of political scientists in the article, but one of the particular scientists is quoted, and it's the very, you know, kicker quote of the article, so it's, you know, very meaningful, saying that if America elects Donald Trump again, we have 2 years or so until the democracy in this country functionally ends. There's another podcast today I see being promoted by Vanity Fair where they have a historian on talking about how Donald Trump is more racialist and worse than Hitler. I mean, there are elements of the Democratic Party that very definitely believe that Donald Trump is some sort of autocratic fascist dictator. And once you label him as that, Donald Trump is a lot of things, and, you know, he causes a lot of problems, but he is not an autocratic fascist dictator who's going to be the end of democracy. And once you label him as such, you're going to justify all manner of things to be done to remove him from office. And the fact that a major party candidate is buying into this narrative is absolutely toxic, and it would be exactly the kind of thing in a sane media environment that the media, if they weren't actively participating in, you know, propagating this narrative, would say, whoa, 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 what's going on here? What are you trying to do here? You're, you know, you're undermining democracy by portraying this dangerous character of Donald Trump that, you know, whatever you want to do to oppose him democratically, it's ridiculous to say that he's an autocrat holding on to power when Democrats, you know, swept the elections in 2018 and currently hold lots of power in Congress. He's not, you know, acting as a dictator. So I think we need some cooler heads prevail, and that would be one thing I think that people need to point out and say that it's really irresponsible of Joe Biden to participate in that narrative.
Molly, how are you hearing Biden's calls for Trump to step down?
I think that it is very dangerous what we're hearing, not just from Biden, but from other members of the establishment, whether officially with the Democratic Party or unofficially. They seem to be laying the groundwork for an open and possibly violent resistance to this election. If Trump wins, there has been a formal resistance since 2016 that has engaged in a lot of malign and nefarious activities, attempting to overthrow constitutional government. And it is very bad that we're seeing these things and printed in newspapers with very little pushback, and people should be very concerned about it. I think it's a big problem.
We're getting an update on the November elections from Molly Hemingway of The Federalist and Mark Hemingway of Real Clear Investigations. After the break, Biden blamed President Trump for the West Coast wildfires. Will voters blame the president as well? My father called me last night. He had just read the latest online Issues Etc. journal. He liked everything that was in it, but he really liked the Wittenberg Trail feature written by rapper Flame about his journey from Bapticostal Christianity through Reformed Baptist Calvinism to Lutheranism. I think my dad said he has quite a story to tell, and you'll enjoy reading it as well in the Wittenberg Trail feature, A Divine Fluke by Flame. You can subscribe to the free online Issues Etc. journal, and you can also read Pastor Will Whedon's article on Lutheran dirges and such. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the red subscription button, enter your email address, and we'll send you the online Issues Etc. journal absolutely free. We'll talk about those wildfires and who's to blame with Mark Hemingway and Molly Hemingway next. Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation.
The entire cost is approximately $375,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org.
Or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
Job saw the city as a wasteland, as if devoid of God, witnessing injustice to the poor by the corrupt, lawlessness of criminals, trafficking of children, blatant immorality, thinking God could not see wicked deeds done in the dark of night. Yet God never abandoned Job, nor his city, groaning for mercy. God is working through the living Redeemer, hands etched with salvation, pointing to the resurrection to come. Join us at lcms.org/citymission to seek peace and shine the light in the city.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Ars Moriendi, the art of dying well. If death is the punishment for sin, then how does one die well? Well, that's the question we ask and answer in the September issue of The Lutheran Witness. We ask and answer the most common questions, fears, and doubts faced by Lutherans and Christians as they approach death. To subscribe, visit cph.org/witness. cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic? And about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
One of the appalling things about systemic racism theory is that in tarring everyone in the oppressor class with the same brush of being a racist, it lets the actual racists among us off the hook.
Well, do you remember where he told the Ten Commandments to be put? They had to go into the ark, right? Into the heart of the ark. And if you stop and think about it, it's like that's a way of picturing to the people they are from the heart of God himself.
Pastors will accommodate what's commonly present in pop culture. TED Talks, the stage sauntering pundit, and the like. And so in this way, the pastor's message undergoes a comprehensive downgrade to the level of the authority that one finds like in the blogosphere.
A relationship before God, a justifying relationship before God is a yes or no. It's in Christ or not in Christ. There's not sort of halfway in Christ, partly believing. No, that's not it at all.
In about 10 minutes, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. You just heard a little bit of the four soundbites on systemic racism. Does it actually reduce racism? Pastor Will Wheaton on the beauty of God's law, answering the question, what happens when a preacher leaves the pulpit? And Pastor Bill Swirla, does faith have an volume dial? You'll be voting for those in about 10 minutes here on Issues Etc. In the meantime, we're getting an update on the November elections with Mark Hemingway and Molly Hemingway. Mark, one of the things that Biden is blaming the president for are the West Coast wildfires. Will the voters blame the president as well?
So I don't know if your listeners recall, but there was a story a few years ago where a handful of ranchers up in Oregon took over the Malheur Forest federal facility in eastern Oregon, and there was a brief protest there that lasted about a month. The FBI infiltrated the group, ended up shooting someone. That whole protest started because what happened was a couple of ranchers in eastern Oregon did a controlled burn on a couple of acres of federal land that abutted their property because they're trying to create a fire break so that if a fire broke out on federal lands, it wouldn't destroy their own property. And they got sentenced to 5 years in prison under mandatory minimums for eco-terrorism that caused a lot of people to be outraged that the sentence didn't correspond with the crime that these ranchers had committed. I mean, there are huge problems with how the federal government goes about managing land and the problems that the fact they are unable to, you know, manage all the land that they own. I think the federal government owns something like 80% of the land in Nevada, and I think it's like 40 or 50% of the land in Oregon. You know, out west, it's a huge, huge issue. But the reason why it got that way, and it stays that way, though, is that liberal environmentalists basically demanded that the Democratic Party, you know, control as much land as possible so that they can keep an eye on development. And there are serious problems with that. One is that, you know, private ownership of property tends to result in much better managed land. And this is an issue that, you know, is complicated, and it's not one the Democratic presidential candidate is going to talk about. He's going to make, you know, a very simple, you know, message about climate change when it's a much more complicated thing involving, you know, land usage and federal neglect.
Molly, to me, it looks like grasping at straws because the only point that's ever been made by, I believe, Governor Newsom is that a lot of these fires are occurring on federally controlled land. What do you make about the charge?
I don't like how anyone uses this for political gain. It's a very complicated story why you have wildfires, and part of it is, you know, something that would happen no matter what the human population was. Part of it is due to gross mismanagement of state and federal lands, and, you know, during the pandemic, while the land management was not considered as essential as it should have been, it is silly to chalk it up to changes in climate as well. It would be more important, I think, for the people of California to just have competent management, competent prosecution of people setting fires, competent management for the naturally set fires. And it's very easy to throw around political insults one way or the other instead of dealing with a problem that is affecting the lives and property of so many people.
Molly, tell us about Trump's rally last night in Wisconsin.
Well, at the beginning of this show, we talked about how Biden was in his element at the CNN town hall where he had friendly questions from supporters. And I would say the same thing about President Trump's rally in Wisconsin last night. It was in the northern portion of Wisconsin. The crowd was so enthusiastic and large and having fun. And Trump spoke at length, went through his policy achievements, went through what he wants to achieve in his second term, had a million riffs on different things. It was kind of like a stand-up show. And it was a reminder of why he was so successful in 2016. And it's also a visual reminder of the difference between his campaign, which is more optimistic, and Biden's campaign, which is rooted in a claim that, you know, the country is suffering mightily from coronavirus, which prevents any normal human interaction. And so it's unclear which will be more successful with voters, but it was definitely a huge difference.
Mark, what did you make of the rally?
It was a fun rally insofar as, you know, Trump rallies are, you know, entertaining affairs. There are definitely times, I think, when you can tell Trump is feeling it more than others, and he definitely felt like he was in his element and was having a lot of fun. It's so weird because Trump is such a huge, you know, person of, you know, at this point in time, I guess, literal historical proportions, you know, so that any changes in his, you know, mood or whatever seem to be discernible. So what I was looking for as someone who, you know, who was, you know, right writes about politics for a living, was to see Trump, you know, sort of feeling his oats there. And I think that his mood is in some ways indicative of success in November. And, you know, so the fact that he seemed to be in a good mood and enjoying himself and you know, being in fine, entertaining form last night, you know, if he can stay that way, it will bode well for him heading into November.
Well, I do think we should note that the average of polls for Wisconsin has Trump easily winning that state. I had a couple of reporters there at the Federalist there last night at the rally, and one of the things they did was ask people about what they thought of those polls, and nobody believes them. And I think the polls were similarly off in 2016 when they predicted Hillary Clinton would win, and of course Trump won it. He won it narrowly, but I don't think people are putting a lot of stock in the polls, but it should be noted that they do have, I think it's like he's got a 7-point lead or something like that. So people who are strategizing for the state, who think Trump definitely can and maybe even will win it, do think he needs to focus on all parts of Wisconsin to make sure he can win it.
Marco, at a White House ceremony on Tuesday, Israel signed unprecedented diplomatic agreements with two Arab states. Tell us about it, and will these agreements have any impact on the presidential race?
Well, so for years there, there's been this kind of, you know, debate about, you know, how to go about easing tensions with Israel in the Middle East. The question is do you have to solve the Palestinian question first, or do you have to go out to other, you know, countries that are, you know, might be favorable in the region or whatever and try and, you know, broker separate deals with them? Well, for a long time, the conventional wisdom was that you could not make any sort of independent deals between Israel and other countries in the Middle East without first pacifying the Shiite mullahs in Iran, who are, you know, have a tense relationship with the broader Sunni community in that area, and solving the Palestinian question, which allegedly was very important to the other Islamic countries in the Middle East that are in close proximity to Israel. And the Trump administration just basically threw the conventional wisdom out the window. There was a lot of criticism that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, who he put in charge of sort of, you know, going out and trying to achieve peace in the Middle East, you know, he was a neophyte and he wouldn't be able to do this. Well, he went out and he got both United Arab Emirates and Bahrain to sign independent peace deals with, you know, Israel, so they could go about and beginning normalizing relations and doing other things. I mean, it's the biggest development for peace in the Middle East in decades. And to say that it is humiliating for the Obama foreign policy team, like, I don't even know where to begin. There was a clip that people were sharing on Twitter last night where John Kerry is in no uncertain terms saying what the Trump administration just did was absolutely impossible. So it's a really, really big deal. And if this were any other political climate and any other president, this would be all people would be talking about. I mean, it's such a signature accomplishment that even if Trump only serves one term, this might be one of the most enduring things if not the most enduring thing we've seen of any president in the last couple of decades. So, yeah, it's a really, really big deal. But, you know, already you see a lot of the typical talking heads in the Middle East, like Jeffrey Goldberg, The Atlantic, and stuff like going out of their way to besmirch this and say that it doesn't mean anything. Well, it only doesn't mean anything because a lot of the same talking heads promoted this conventional wisdom that turned out to be entirely wrong, and the Trump administration proved them to be entirely wrong.
Molly, what are your thoughts?
Well, I would just note that Jeffrey Goldberg, who's the editor of The Atlantic, has been wrong on many foreign policy issues for decades, and it is very weird how in Washington, D.C., you can be not just wrong, but catastrophically wrong about major issues like war and how to fight war and whether to fight war, and there seem to be no repercussions for it. But as Mark said, this is huge. I think very few people thought it was possible. I myself was skeptical if it was possible. And I do want to point out that the Trump administration did go first to the Palestinians. So even though the Palestinians rejected their offer, the Trump administration did try to establish peace between these cohorts in Israel first. Just that when they got a no, they didn't stop there. They went ahead and showed these other countries that it could still be there in their interest to normalize relations with Israel. And hopefully that will give the pressure needed to encourage Palestinians to focus more on improving the economic lot of their own people and working towards some kind of agreement. Because that does still need to be resolved, obviously. But hopefully this outside pressure can help in some way. but it is something to be hopeful for. And I know a lot of people pray for peace all the time, and it's nice when there can be good news like this in a region that's fraught with conflict.
Molly, there was a story in the Federalist this week about the inability of pollsters to accurately poll the Midwest. Tell us about it.
I was referencing this with the Wisconsin discussion. I just find it interesting that the polls are getting like cartoonishly favorable toward Biden, but nobody seems to be believing them. And I don't encourage people to disbelieve polls, but I think there is a sense that the polls are not accurately capturing reality or, you know, anything that people experience in their day-to-day conversations. You know, you don't want to ignore them, but there are problems. And Sean Trendy, who's this polling expert, had a piece that we republished at the Federalist that was looking at just statistically, pollsters routinely undercount Republican turnout in Midwestern states, and it's a problem that has plagued them. And they claimed that they had it fixed between 2016 and 2018, but it actually still was a problem in 2018. And it is worth noting that the errors always seem to go in the same direction. The errors always seem to benefit Democrats. And it's important to get these things right. Not that I'm confident that pollsters want to get them right necessarily, because polling forms such a big part of political news coverage for the purpose of affecting turnout. So people would say in 2016, well, the final polls weren't off that much. They had Hillary Clinton winning the general vote by, you know, a small percentage, and she did. But that's not the problem with polling. The problem with polling is, A, you know, not thinking about how elections are actually won in the Electoral College, but B, when you have a false narrative that's being put out there week after week, month after month, that it is an impossibility, for instance, for Trump to win, it affects people and it affects their ability to be confident in coming out and saying who they support. And so it's the polling in, you know, April, May, June, July, August, September that matters almost as much as the polling in the last 2 weeks of October, when most pollsters will kind of clean up their act and get it closer to what reality might be. And I think this year is maybe an even worse example of that than we've seen in previous years.
You can read Mark and Molly Hemingway's columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor, senior editor at The Federalist, and co-author of the book Justice on Trial. Molly, thanks.
Thank you.
And Mark Hemingway, senior writer for Real Clear Investigations. Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
When we come back on this Friday afternoon, the 18th of September, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. During a global pandemic, how can we find comfort in the hymn, From God Can Nothing Move Me? You'll find the answer in Pastor Will Whedon's column on Lutheran Dirges and Such in the latest Issues Etc. journal. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, rapper Flame details his journey from Bapticostal and Reformed Baptist Calvinism to confessional Lutheranism. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Concordia University Chicago is committed to keeping college affordable for all, and especially for LCMS Lutherans. We have scholarships available specifically for students who are LCMS members. This is Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia Chicago, asking you to encourage your student to check out Concordia Chicago at cuchicago.edu. And if you are interested in supporting these scholarships, please find us online at foundation@cuchicago.edu.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at siestakeyrentalgenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Looking for a faithful Lutheran church in East Central Oklahoma? Welcome to Trinity Okmulgee, a friendly and faithful LCMS congregation only 40 miles south of Tulsa. Hi, This is Pastor Chris Teebs. Check us out at trinityokmulgee.org. That's Trinity, O-K-M-U-L-G-E-E, all one word, .org. See you soon at Trinity Okmulgee, Oklahoma.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
I like to think of the deaconess vocation as driven by two things, the love of Christ and the needs of our neighbor.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. James Buescher, Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the vocation of deaconess.
First, the deaconess is moved by the love of Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve. Yet I think we can also see the profound needs around us, broken families, loneliness, despair. Deaconesses help the church to become a true family that manifests the love of Christ in our love for one another, and especially for those in need.
For more information on the Deaconess Studies program at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit ctsfw.edu or call Concordia Theological Seminary at 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155.